The Judiciary Committee will come to order. Julia, please call the roll.
Chair Gregory.
Here.
Vice Chair Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Ranking Member Gottlieb.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Arrington.
Here.
Barnaby.
Here.
Botana.
Here.
Bracy Davis.
Here.
Brannon.
Here.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Here.
Gilombardo.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
Maggard.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
Payne.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Stark.
Here.
Trunow. A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you, members. First, I want to say welcome. We've gained three new members to the Judiciary Committee. So welcome, Representative Botana, Representative Chamberlain, Representative Joseph. Good to see you in Judiciary Committee. Hope you have lots of good questions, and we look forward to your debate as we hear bills. I want to remind everyone here in the audience to please silence your cell phones, and members too, of course. And reminder that you need to turn the microphone on when you come up to present and you're speaking. And if you haven't done so and you wish to speak, please fill out a public appearance card. Today we're considering five bills. First up is going to be House Bill HB 487, Lost and Abandoned Property. Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Gregory. Thank you, committee, for hearing my bill. This is a very simple bill that passed unanimously, bipartisan, in its first committee. It very simply streamlines the process that we remove derelict vessels so that we have cleaner water, safer water, and preservation of our law enforcement resources. That is the bill.
Thank you. Members, are there questions on the bill? Seeing no questions, I do see an amendment. You're recognized to explain the First Amendment, barcode 582561.
This amendment simply corrects some statute references. It's technical.
Members, any questions on the amendment? Any public testimony on the amendment? Seeing none, are there any members that wish to debate? Seeing none, Representative Cheney, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
Wave close.
All right, without objection, show the amendment is adopted. Is there a public testimony on the bill? First up, we have Jess Melkin from FWC, Legislative Affairs Director, waving in support. Thank you. Any others? Any members wishing to debate on the bill? Seeing none, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Wave close.
Having closed on her bill, Julia, please call the roll on House Bill 487 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman. Altman. Arrington.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Bracy Davis.
Yes.
Brannon.
Yes.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Yes.
Gilombardo.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Hart. Hart. Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Yes.
Joseph.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Payne.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Stark.
Yes.
Trunow.
Yes.
Chair Gregory.
Yes.
19 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Show House Bill 487 reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Next up, we're going to hear CS for House Bill 305 from Representative Baker. Representative Baker, you're recognized to present the bill.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member, for the opportunity to present this bill. HB 305 adds human trafficking of a minor to the list of offenses for which a single conviction requires an offender to be designated as a sexual predator. Human trafficking of a minor is a life felony, and all other convictions for life felonies regarding sexual offenses against minors are automatically designated as a sexual predator, so this bill makes it all consistent. Additionally, the bill increases the age at which the child hearsay exception applies from 16 to 17 years of age or less. This makes the exception consistent for all minors, and that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions on the bill? Seeing none, I see no amendments on the bill. Is there public testimony on the bill? Okay, I've got a couple. First, I have Mr. Barney Bishop. Thank you very much. Next, Nancy Lothar from Florida PTA. Also waving in support. Thank you. Any members wishing to debate on the bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Chambliss, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the representative for bringing this good bill forward. Really appreciate it. Miami-Dade is one of those spots in the state of Florida that has a huge problem with human trafficking, and every angle in which we can address that issue is definitely a move in the right direction. Hopefully we'll continue to make our state safer for our children. So again, thank you for this bill.
Thank you for breaking the ice, Representative Chambliss. It's only fitting that you're the first one to debate in Judiciary in 2024. I really do appreciate your debate and your comments. Anybody else? Okay, now you're recognized to close on the bill.
I'll waive close.
Did they fill out a form? Was there somebody else? Mr. Kennedy, public comment on the bill? Okay, I'm sorry we missed you. Come on up. And what organization are you representing?
Florida Citizens Alliance.
Okay, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judiciary Committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Ryan Kennedy. I'm with the Florida Citizens Alliance, a group of over 260,000 supporters in Florida. Two-thirds of those are parents with children 17 and under in home. So this issue to us is hits close to home. We are a strong supporter of this bill. We particularly like the idea of the sexual predator update. To us, as the sponsor said, it makes complete sense to keep consistent, and also, especially because we have an invested interest in education, obviously what comes along with that designation is also important for school safety and children's safety. So thank you.
Thank you. Sorry we missed you the first time. We appreciate your public comment. Did that additional comment drive any other debate? All right. Seeing none, you're recognized to close again.
I'll waive close again.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Having closed on her bill, Julia, please call the roll on CS for House Bill 305 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Botana. Yes. Bracy Davis.
Yes.
Brannon.
Yes.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Yes.
Gilombardo.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Hart. Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Yes.
Joseph.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes, ma'am.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Payne.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Stark.
Yes.
Trunow.
Yes.
Chair Gregory.
Yes.
20 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Congratulations. Show the bill reported favorably out of Judiciary. Next up, we'd like to hear PCS for CS for House Bill 385, the Safe Exchange of Minor Children, by Representatives Rudman and Cassell. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member. Members of the committee, a lot of you might remember this bill from last year's version. Y'all probably remember it as the Purple Light Bill. This is that bill that provides for at least one safe custody exchange location in each county of the state. Such location will be in the parking lot of a sheriff's station or substation. It will be signified by the presence of a purple light, and it will have video monitoring capability 24/7. And of course, it will be a well-lit place. This is that bill that was approved unanimously through committee last year, as well as approved unanimously in the House. There are, in my opinion, three important changes to this year's version. However, three what I think are improvements, and I'll notify you of those. Number one, this year's version of the bill allows the sheriffs to determine the precise location of the custody exchange location instead of the county commissioners. Number two, in terms of who gets to use the location or which location or when they use the location, we're putting that squarely under the jurisdiction of the courts. So in other words, whenever there's discussion of a parenting plan, whenever a parenting plan is being created, revised, changed, modified, the courts must consider the location of these safe exchange locations. And finally, and most importantly, if you have someone who is filling out a petition for protection from domestic violence, on that form now, there will be a box that the applicant can check to ask the court that future custody exchanges take place at the secure location. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions on the bill? Representative Chambliss, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Rutman, Representative Cassell. Definitely, this is a great bill. I do have a question. In Miami-Dade County, we do not have a sheriff, and we will have a sheriff after the next election. So what is the, and forgive me for not reading the whole thing, what is the effective date of the bill?
You're recognized.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe the effective date will be July 1st.
Do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, sir. Is there any way to see how that would affect Miami-Dade County, and so that Miami-Dade County, upon effective date, would also be able to participate in the program compared to us waiting until, you know, our sheriff is actually in office, which would be post-November 2024?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is an excellent question. And it has actually been brought to my attention previously, the particular situation in Miami-Dade. That's just a wording issue. I would say it would probably fall upon your current designee. That would be the person who would decide.
Any further questions? All right, seeing none, are there amendments on the bill? Seeing none, is there public testimony? All right, we've got a few cards here. First up, from the Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office, Roman Jackson. Major Jackson, you're recognized.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Major Roman Jackson. I stand before you as a representative for Sheriff Bob Johnson of Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office, urging your support for the proposed legislation by Dr. Rudman, the Cassie Carley Bill. On March 28, 2022, our community was rocked by the disappearance of Cassie Carley, a young, vibrant mother scheduled to meet her child's father on Navarre Beach the day prior. Cassie vanished, and this subsequent investigation led our detectives across three states, 1,500 miles before discovering her lifeless body in a shallow grave in Springville, Alabama. Cassie's ex and the father of her child, Marcus, was indicted for her kidnapping, resulting in the death. The pain of losing Cassie and the horrifying circumstances surrounding her death are etched in our hearts. It's a stark reminder of the issues and the challenges that parents face during child custody exchanges. By supporting the Cassie Carley Bill, we not only honor the memory of a young life cut short, but we also take a concrete action to safeguard parents and children alike. These secure exchange points will serve as beacons of safety, offering peace of mind to parents and navigating the complexities of shared custody. It is our collective responsibility as representatives of the people to address the issue head on. Let us not turn a blind eye and have another incident like Cassie's occur. We must advocate for comprehensive measures to ensure the safety of exchanges, protecting vulnerable families from harm, and let us unite in support of this vital bill, acknowledging the need for a comprehensive system that prioritizes parents and children during the critical moments. The Cassie Carley Bill is a beacon of hope, a promise to our community that we are committed in preventing further heartbreak. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Jackson. Next up, also a supporter of the bill, Mr. Varney Bishop. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. And from the Florida PTA, Nancy Lothar. Thank you. From the Family Law section of the Florida Bar, Anya Stern. Ms. Stern, you recognize?
And members of the committee, my name is Anya Cintron Stern. I'm a family law attorney. I've been practicing approximately 15 years in Miami-Dade County. And I want to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Rudman for taking this tragic loss of Cassie Carley's life and bringing some hope, a sense of security, a sense of peace of mind to Florida's families. The family law section is extremely thankful for Dr. Redmond. For the past couple of years, in fact, he has intentfully, thoughtfully listened to the suggestions and concerns of the family law section. And over the last 2 years, this bill has truly been refined to ensure that the safety of their parents, safety of the children, are at the forefront of these issues within family law. At the same time, this bill carefully considers the legal principles that we hold so dear, the principles of due process, the principles of an opportunity to be heard, the principles of notice, and we believe that it's satisfactorily met. This is a bill that the family law bench, the general magistrates, the family law judges will be able to enact, will be able to identify these high conflict families, and we'll be able to take some action to ensure that the exchanges are taking place in a safe and secure location. It is a bill that we believe that the family law judges will be able to bring forward carefully. Why? It's because it's not in the arena of the domestic violence injunction. It's not in the arena of the criminal courts. It's in the family court itself. So the judges are having the discretion to determine whether these families need to be at a safe exchange location or whether they need to be at a supervised visitation center, which has a little bit more third-party involvement in monitoring. In many of our high conflict cases, we have families exchanging children at public parking lots, such as Publix or grocery stores, CVSs, at drugstores, but they don't have the accountability to ensure that it is always well lit, that there is always video surveillance, but this bill does just that. So this is a very organic and natural build from Grayson's Law that was passed last year. And we hope that this committee understands how much this could really help Florida's families. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stern. Next up, we have Ms. Stacy Cole. Ms. Cole, you're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity and the honor to stand before you today. My name is Stacy Michelle Cole, and I'm here to advocate on behalf of HB 385 in honor of my dear friend, Cassie Carley. As you've already heard, Cassie was violently murdered by her child's father during a child custody exchange. Cassie was a bright light to everyone who knew her. She was highly educated. She was skilled in self-defense. She was a tower of strength as she fought her way through the family Florida court system seeking a protection from abuse order that she was denied. Most importantly, Cassie was well aware of Marcus's violent tendencies, and she often said, "If anything happens to me, it is him." On the day that Cassie went missing, she did everything correct. At the last minute when Marcus changed the location, she phoned a friend just 5 minutes prior to arriving in that dark, unlit, unsupervised, and scarcely populated parking lot. It wasn't enough. If HB 385 were in existence in March of 2022, Cassie would still be alive today. I am currently a Florida educator at Vernon Middle School, and my number one goal for my students is to keep them safe. By saying yes to this bill, you are not only bringing honor and justice to my friend Cassie, but you are saving countless lives, including the lives of my students who will one day be Florida mothers and fathers. I believe that this bill needs to be a law in every state in our nation. I love living in Florida. I've only lived here for a few years, but I believe that Florida leads the way. Please say yes and illuminate a lot for Cassie that every other state will follow. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members that wish to debate on the bill? Vice Chair Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Representative Cassell and Dr. Rubin, thank you for bringing this forward. And I want to everyone to remember that it's really about the kids first. They've been put in a situation that they have no control over whatsoever, and you're providing an opportunity to have that safe exchange. So I sincerely appreciate that. And this actually really rocked our district as well, most recently on December 30th when a young man was killed during a heated exchange of a child going back and forth between the parents. And so this is something that really hits home for me as well. So thank you for bringing this forward. Thank you for putting kids first and also for this safe opportunity to exchange our children. Appreciate that.
Representative Payne, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the bill. 100% supportive on the bill. Just want to know what else we can do to enhance the safety of these exchange locations. As the bill moves forward, maybe consider designating some specific spots. I want to talk to you offline about what those might be. Thank you.
I just want to say that, you know, many times we observe that bad facts will give us bad law, but sometimes when you have members working hard enough and you've got, you know, great support from the community and members and family and law enforcement, you can take bad, horrific facts and make good law, and I think that's what you've done here, so I appreciate that. And with that, you're recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing my bill. I've got my prime co-sponsor here with me because I wasn't sure I'd be able to get through the proceedings today. So this is a very emotional bill for me. I never had the pleasure to meet Cassie Carley, but y'all have to understand this tragedy happened on my beach. Matter of fact, it happened in a parking lot, not 200 yards from where my son goes to the beach to play drums. The people on the search parties that were organized to search for Cassie Carley, those were friends of mine. So this bill is very personal to me. There was someone who wanted to be here today to testify from my district. Her name is Kirstie Sullivan. She's organized a Facebook page called Justice for Cassie Carley. I've been trying now for 2 years to get justice for Cassie Carley and to honor her memory. And I realize that here today, this committee can honor Cassie Carley by voting up on this bill and saving future Cassie Carleys. With that, I close.
Representative Rubin, having closed on the bill, Julia, please call the roll on PCS for CS for House Bill 385 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Racy Davis.
Yes.
Brannon.
Yes.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Yes.
Gilombardo. Yes. Gottlieb.
Yes.
Hart.
Yes.
Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Yes.
Joseph. Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes, ma'am.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Payne.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Snyder. Yes. Stark.
Yes.
Trunow.
Yes.
Chair Gregory.
Yes.
21 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Congratulations. Show the bill reported favorably. Next up, we have House Bill 461, Excusal from Jury Service by Representative Amnesty. You're recognized to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, ranking members, and committee members for the opportunity to present before you all this morning. Florida continues to lead the way, placing families first in every aspect of life. The purpose of House Bill 461 is to allow women who have given birth less than 6 months before being summoned for jury service to be excused upon request. Strong and healthy families should be at the heart of our state's policymaking. With this bill, Florida will join ranks with other of dozen of states as politically diverse as California and Iowa and allow new mothers to be excused from jury duty. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I see we have one amendment on the bill, barcode 826435. You're recognized to explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of this amendment is to eliminate the word written from the request, as upon my meeting with the Florida clerks, most do not process written requests, but rather electronic requests. The other aspect that was eliminated was the request for the child's birth certificate. According to Florida Statute 382.025, it states that birth certificates are confidential records except for birth records over 124 years of age. That is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, before we move to questions on that amendment, were there any questions on the bill before the amendment? All right, seeing none, any questions on the amendment? And And seeing none, any public testimony on the amendment? Yes. All right, first up, I've got Mr. Jason Welty from the Jefferson County Clerk of Court, waiving in support. Is that correct? Waiving in support? Thank you, sir. And from the Florida Court Clerks and Comptrollers Association, Morgan Parrish, also waiving in support. Thank you. Are there any members that wish to debate on the amendment? Seeing none, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
Oh, the amendment. The bill.
You want to wait till the bill. Okay, you're recognized to close on the amendment.
I waive to close on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Without objection, show the amendment is adopted. Back on the bill as amended. Any public testimony on the bill? We've got one. Mr. Barney Bishop. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Any others? That's it. Any members wishing any public testimony on the bill further than that? Seeing none. Any members wishing to debate? Yes, sir. Mr. Barnaby, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Happy New Year to you. I want to thank the sponsor for this wonderful bill. I want to say how important it is for us to stand in support with the sponsor in support of women and children. And I thank you for this very good bill. I'm up on it, and hope all my colleagues are unanimous as well.
Thank you, Representative Barnaby. Anybody else wishing to debate? Seeing none, Representative Amnesty, recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill is important. Strong and healthy families should be at the heart of our state's policymaking. In the Sunshine State, we're committed to helping women bond with their babies during these invaluable early moments. I look forward to counting with your support. And with that, I close.
Thank you. Representative Amnesty, having closed on her bill, Julia, please call the roll on House Bill 461 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Racy Davis.
Yes.
Brannon.
Yes.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Yes.
Gilombardo.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Hart.
Yes.
Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Yes.
Joseph.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes, ma'am.
Overdorf. Payne.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Stark.
Yes.
Trunow.
Yes.
Chair Gregory.
Yes.
21 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Congratulations. Show House Bill 461 reported favorably as amended. All right, members, we have one more bill for consideration and then the presentation. So next up, our own Ranking Member Gottlieb to present House Bill 187, Anti-Semitism. You're welcome, Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair. I'm proud to present House Bill 187. House Bill 187 takes the definition that was enacted in 2016 by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and it places the definition of anti-Semitism into Florida statutes. Believe it or not, there was no working definition in Florida statutes other than in the education space. And the bill provides basically guardrails as to what is anti-Semitic hate speech and creates a protocol to sort of follow that. The bill gives numerous examples of what is anti-Semitic hate speech, and anti-Semitism is up well over 400% since October 7th. That is what the bill does, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gottlieb. Are there any questions on the bill? Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We started getting into some of this a little bit before committee, and I know we ran out of time. So I had a series of questions about specific language within the bill. I guess one of my overarching questions is, are you willing, I know it's not your bill, it's Senator Berman's bill, and I'm gonna talk to her about some of this stuff, but to the extent that I'm trying to get consensus from both of you, I'm concerned that criticism of the state of Israel and or actions of the state would be deemed anti-Semitic under this law. And I know that the Anti-Defamation League specifically has said, to be sure, and I'm going to quote this, to be sure, one can harshly criticize Israel's leaders and actions without being anti-Semitic. Would including some kind of language expressly stating that criticism of the state of Israel and or its leaders and agents would not be anti-Semitic under this definition proposed in the bill?
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I don't think the bill in its current form creates that criticism in and of itself is hate speech, but I'm certainly willing to have a conversation. And you have, prior to the meeting today, indicated line 75, I think, to 80 were the lines that you felt perhaps were offensive of the First Amendment. So I'm willing absolutely to listen and see if there's any changes that might be made. It is my bill, but Senator Berman brought it to me over the summer. Happy to listen and see, but I think what it is it's criticism that rises to the level of hate speech, and that's what we're talking about is speech that is not constitutionally protected. To criticize is fine, but when it rises to the level of hate speech is what the bill is intended to address. But again, open to hearing your concerns.
Representative Joseph, you're recognized for follow-up questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the response, and I thank you for your amenability to working with me on the bill. So just to highlight it so that you'll have it, I had my aide, she just delivered these to me. I'm gonna have you pass that down, pass this down, and I'm gonna give this to you too. The ones that you identified, the two sections which were at the line 75 through 80. Rep Hart, would you mind passing this to the front row? And this is for later. I'm not getting into that article that I'm passing out now, but I'm just presenting it for the record, I suppose. And the article is titled, How a Leading Definition of Anti-Semitism Has Been Weaponized Against Israel's Critics, dated December 27th, 2023. I'm not gonna get into the details of it now, but it highlights those specific ones so we can get it. And I'm also sharing this for Senator Berman's kind of pre-heads up, so when we talk about it, she'll have an idea of what the concern is. So not belaboring that point, moving on to my concern about this particular definition of anti-Semitism.
Representative Joseph, I'm sorry, we're still on questions. Is there
yes.
a question or
there is like a you're question. In debate? I'm just kind of leading into the question.
Okay. If you go ahead, you're recognized.
A little latitude. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next question is, there are a lot of definitions that have been proposed to define anti-Semitism, and I join you in that desire to make sure that we root out anti-Semitism to the extent it's weaponized against Jewish people and other Semites. My question for you is, there are other kinds of definitions that have been proposed. Did you consider any of those other definitions before settling on the one by the IHRC?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, we considered many different definitions. This is the definition that is most worldwidely accepted. I had a count of the number of countries. I think it's over 40 countries and over 25 states have enacted this definition, whether through their governor or through their legislative bodies. And so this one is the one that's most commonly used and, again, accepted for the past 7 years.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you're recognized. Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, without getting into too much more detail about the concerns that I discussed with you with this current definition, there was a definition proposed by the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which is a group of Holocaust scholars that try to kind of nip anti-Semitism in the bud, if you will. And their definition was anti-Semitism is discrimination, prejudice, hostility, or violence against Jews as Jews or Jewish institutions as Jewish. That's different than the definition that's proposed in your bill. Is that something that sounds workable for you as an alternative definition?
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, I'm interested in having a further conversation with anybody who would like to talk to me about the possibility of expanding the definition of anti-Semitism. I think what you're referring to when you say the definition is the numerous examples in the bill. Those are not the definition of anti-Semitism. Those are historical examples of anti-Semitic speech, anti-Semitic hate speech. But those are not the definition. I think you're conflating the two. But again, I am amenable to listening to any additional comments or concerns that would make this a better bill.
You have another question, Representative Joseph?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I want to draw your attention to the language. There was one that really stuck out to me. Another one, other than the ones I got a chance to talk to you about. So in lines 56 through 61 of the bill, the specific language I'm concerned about, I'll give you a second to get there, is making allegations about the power of Jewish people as a collective, controlling the media, economy, government, and or other societal institutions. So lots of people are making a lot of those kinds of comments these days. So I want to make sure I understand, based on this illustrative example definition of what would be constituting anti-Semitism, are all forms of that, would that make it, as a matter of law, for criminal purposes and otherwise, in Florida law, anti-Semitic to say anything about those kinds of things?
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm not sure I understand the entirety of your question, but you know what that's talking about is traditionally false, misleading statements suggesting that Jews who represent 0.02% of the world's population control the media or somehow control the economy or the government or other societal institutions, which are clearly false and harmful to the existence of the Jewish people. Yes, the intention is to have those false and misleading, harmful statements, which are part of the hate crimes, to have them be part of Florida's definition of anti-Semitism.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You recognize Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So recently, there was a statement made by Alan Dershowitz, who will be representing Israel before the International Criminal Tribunal in South Africa's claim against Israel for genocide. In this statement, and I want to see if this statement fits, would be considered anti, the question is, will this statement that I'm about to read be considered anti-Semitism under this bill in that particular illustration that I identified? And I quote, "People say Jews are too powerful, we're too strong, we're too rich, we control the media, we have too much this, or we have too much that, and we often apologetically deny our strength and our power. Don't do that. Don't do that. We have earned the right to influence public debate. We have earned the right to be heard. We have contributed disproportionately to the success of this country. Never, ever apologize for using our strength and our influence in the interest of peace. And if you need a biblical source for it, just remember the psalmist who said, Hashem uz liam utam. God will give the Jewish people strength, oz, and then only then, and he says a Hebrew prayer, only then will God give the Jewish people peace. Peace will come for the Jewish people and the Jewish nation only through strength. Would that constitute anti-Semitism under that section of your bill?
Representative Gottlieb, would you like to answer a hypothetical question based on the excerpt from what is probably a longer speech?
Yeah, I can answer that. Thank you.
You're recognized.
So I'm just a lowly lawyer, not a judge yet. So I wouldn't be the arbiter of that, but I don't think that the intention that Alan Dershowitz had when he said that Jews should accept their strength was intended in any way, shape, or form to be hate speech. And I think that my bill addresses hate speech. And clearly, I think the excerpt that you read was not intended to be hate speech. And so, no, I don't think that it would be prohibited by my bill.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
We're very, very close, if not already across the line into the debate. Do you have anything else that's question and not debate?
I do.
How many more do you have?
Maybe one.
One more question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're recognized.
All right. So my question, let me move that. I actually agree with, thank you for the response. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the response. I actually agree with you that it would not be anti-Semitic, but the way the bill is drafted doesn't really give somebody a way to make that decision. It's codifying it throughout Florida law, but there's no way to do it.
But let me just stop you for a moment. You're debating his answer to the last question.
Here's the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the question is about the linguistic determination of Semitism. And a Semite is a member of a group of people who speak or spoke a Semitic language, which includes Hebrew, spoken by Jews, Arabic, spoken by a number of countries, not necessarily tied to religion, Aramaic, the language spoken by Jesus, specifically the Galilean dialect of Aramaic, and Amharic, spoken in Ethiopia. My question for you is, in using anti-Semitic in its purest linguistic sense, I understand in the United States that anti-Semitism is usually attached to Jewish people primarily, but anti-Semitism in a global sense, in terms of a definition, if we're seeking to define it, applies to many more people other than just Jews. How is the bill addressing that kind of truth, if at all? How does it address that kind of reality in terms of what anti-Semitism is in a larger context beyond what we think about it in the United States?
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm not sure the bill does that. What the bill does is takes the IHRA definition. The IHRA is the only intergovernmental organization that's been mandated to focus on anti-Semitism. This was the definition of anti-Semitism that was proposed by this intergovernmental agency. And as I said, there's, I believe, 40 different nations, including the United Nations, which I don't always agree with, that have chosen to adopt this and or are looking at it. What the bill does, if you'll look more specifically at lines 38 to 43, mm-hmm. is it specifies that it's the intent of the legislature to adopt this working definition developed by the IHRA of the terms of anti-Semitism, and it doesn't define it in the way that you did it, just anti-Semitism, including all Semites, to assist in the monitoring and reporting of anti-Semitic hate crimes, monitoring and reporting, and discrimination, and to make residents aware of and to combat such incidents in this state. And that's what the intention of the bill is.
Thank you, Representative Gottlieb. Any other members with questions? Seeing no amendments on the bill, is there public testimony on the bill? All right, first up, Major Jackson from the Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office. Waving in support of the bill. And once more, Mr. Barney Bishop, waving in support from the Florida Smart Justice Alliance. Any members wishing to debate on the bill? Representative Barnaby, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the bill sponsor for bringing this good bill. I understand in listening to the questions from at least one of my colleagues that it appears that you could try to turn yourself into a pretzel all day long, but clearly this is about discrimination against Jewish people, okay? I'm a black man, I'm an American. We could break down the history of my history and my heritage, but this is not about the Jewish heritage, the breakdown of what it means to be anti-Semitic. Stevie Wonder can see what anti-Semitic is. And he's blind, apparently. But without getting technical, this is not a technical question. This is a clear question of how to put into the Florida statutes that we are against discrimination against Jewish people, just like we are against discrimination against black people. We're against discrimination against white people. We are against all forms of discrimination. And I thank, again, the bill sponsor for bringing this simple but very good bill. And I urge my colleagues to be up on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members wishing to debate? Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, thank the bill sponsor for endeavoring to take on anti-Semitism, which is on the rise, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And I believe it needs to be combated. I also think it's important to be very careful in how we combat it. What we have seen with this particular definition is that when codified, it has been weaponized against people who are seeking to either support the Palestinian cause or to address nuances and criticism against Israel, which I don't believe is the bill sponsor's, either of the bill sponsor's intent. And to kind of break that down a little bit further, you know, there has been the actual author of the bill, Kenneth Stern, the lead author, who even in the definition of the bill, which the bill sponsor read, was drafted for the purpose of collecting data and gathering statistics. And he has repeatedly argued against its domestic use in legislation or policy, because that was not the purpose of this this working definition. Attempts to codify this IHRA definition have been strongly opposed by a broad cross-section of civil liberties groups, Jewish and Palestinian human rights organizations, which include but are not limited to the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Palestine Legal, Jewish Voice for Peace, Bend the Arc, Jewish Action, the U.S. Reform Movement, J Street, and also major newspaper editorial boards like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. In March 2022, the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure condemned attempts to codify the IHRA definition, suggesting that these laws, quote, expand the definition of anti-Semitism to encompass political speech with several discriminatory effects, end quote. And the AAUP urged to opposing this kind of legislation and these initiatives in order to protect academic freedom vital to the preservation of democracy. Again, I am with you when it comes to protecting both Jews and other Semites against discrimination, but I think this particular definition is problematic, as is highlighted in some of the things that I have shared and will share with you. Another example, citing one of our own colleagues here in the Florida legislature, in a prior attempt to adopt the IHRA definition, he explained his hopes of what the bill would achieve in these terms, and I quote, "Students for Justice in Palestine is now treated the same way as the Ku Klux Klan, as they should be," end quote. And I know that that's not the current bill sponsor's intent, but that is one of the things that has been stated in the past, as published in February 20th, 2020. So I think what I'm trying to say and what it boils down to is attacks on Semites, Jewish and otherwise, by white supremacists and other groups who seek to discriminate against, demean, and harm people are on the rise. And that's whether you're talking about on Jewish people or Palestinian people. Just recently in Newark, Imam Hassam Sharif was killed. Earlier in Illinois, a six-year-old, Wadia al-Fayoumi, was killed. These are also technically anti-Semitic attacks. Now, I'm against attacks on all individuals based on their race, religion, and other immutable characteristics, which a lot of the law already protects against. I think this particular definition in its current form is problematic. I look forward to eventually being able to vote up on a revised version of it, but in its current form and its implications for First Amendment political and free speech, I have to vote against it today. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have one more member in debate. Vice Chair Overdorf, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Ranking Member Gottlieb, I've always known you to be a man that reviews what he is presenting with the utmost integrity. You have a long history of making sure that the legislation that you bring forward addresses all sides. And for that alone, I support this bill, but also for the language that is within it, fully support it. I thank you for bringing it forward. You have my 100% full support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative, not yet Judge Gottlieb, you're recognized. Close on your bill.
And that's another job that I'm not sure that I want. So as you know, as I said, it's my pleasure to bring the bill. But it's sad that I have to. You know, when World War II was started and the extermination of the Jews began, there were, I believe, 16 million Jews throughout the world, and 6 million were killed. And today, there are only 15 million Jews in the world. So anti-Semitism is a tremendous problem. And while I hear and understand the concerns that the definition has been weaponized, you know, not really that concerned about that, because I think any definition may be weaponized, and speech can always be weaponized. I think the concern is that when you have a high school basketball girls team, as just happened last week, I believe, in New Jersey, that a Jewish day school was playing another school, and the physicality of the game became so brutal, and the elbows that were being thrown and the verbiage that was being used against these girls, and they were telling them that you should go effing die, and that Hamas, what they did was great on October 7th. We shouldn't have to suffer those kind of indignities. And that's what this bill is intended to address. And the fact that it may offend some people, I understand. And the comments are that many different groups, including the ACLU, so on and so forth, are strongly against this. This is a meeting that was publicly noticed. And there's nobody here to talk against the bill. So whatever historical arguments that were being utilized to suggest that many groups are opposed to the bill, other than you, I've had one individual who reached out to me this morning, and I explained to that individual, and he represents a Muslim Islamic group, and I told him I'd be happy to talk to him about his concerns. And I am aware that there are some First Amendment concerns. But the First Amendment does not allow the United States Constitution and the First Amendment, it is the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, does not allow for hate speech, certain kinds of hate speech. And anti-Semitism should be protected and should be codified in Florida statutes. This is the definition that I've proudly chosen to go with. It's the definition that an international governmental group has decided is the best definition of anti-Semitism. And, you know, I think this sadly needs to be addressed. This bill was came to me over the summer, prior to October 7th, and there's no more important time to address this epidemic of hate and to help tamp it down. And with that, I ask for your favorable support.
Representative Gottlieb having on his bill, Julia, please call the roll on House Bill 187 and announce the vote.
Representatives Altman.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Racy Davis.
Yes.
Brannon.
Yes.
Chamberlain has been excused. Chambliss.
Yes.
Gillombardo.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Hart.
Yes.
Hinson has been excused. Jock.
Yes.
Joseph.
No for now.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes, ma'am.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Payne.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Snyder. Stark.
Yes.
Trunow.
Yes.
Chair Gregory.
Yes.
20 yeas, one nay, Mr. Chair.
Congratulations. Show House Bill 187 reported favorably. Members, we have a presentation today. That presentation is on a potential alternative to the Florida workers' compensation system currently in place. We have with us Jennifer Hurlis from the Association for Responsible Alternatives to Workers' Compensation. Members, I'm going to open the floor to questions at the conclusion of the presentation. We've got about 35 minutes left. So, Ms. Hurlis, if you can try to limit the presentation. I know you got 10 or 12 slides to 15 minutes or so, so that members can ask questions. And you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, Ranking Member, Committee members, and staff for the opportunity to be here today. Thank you. Should I run it with you? That's great. I'm here to introduce a policy that has worked well for injured workers and their employers in other states, and if enacted in the state of Florida, has the ability to lower the cost of claims, improve medical outcomes, and lost time from work, and lower litigation rates for work-related injury claims in Florida. So as you guys all know, every state manages its own workers' comp and tort system. And in most states, Florida included, participation in that system is mandatory. So there really is no choice for employers to make other than maybe the deductible, what carrier they want to work with, what vendors they want to work with. Otherwise, the statute and the regulations they govern. So there's really nothing allowed to compete against the system itself because participation in the system is mandated by statute. So this policy that I'm introducing would create competition in the work injury space by allowing an alternative to Florida workers' compensation. So this employer choice and competition will drive results across the work injury spectrum that will benefit injured workers and employers both. So before I jump into the detail, I want to tackle a couple of myths that I think have prevented us from talking about a reimagined competitive system for resolving work-related injuries. First, workers' compensation rates are low. And in fact, in Florida, you're looking at another rate decrease of about 15.1%. So, I mean, business is good in Florida. And you may assume with even another, well, yeah. But this conclusion fails to recognize that really these insurance rates, they're only one component of the employer's cost. Their other cost elements are the cost of the claim below the deductible, so benefits that the employer has to pay before insurance kicks in. There's also administrative costs, service fees, bill repricing, work price production loss. These are not decreasing. The second myth, I think as a business-friendly environment that Florida is known for, Florida's pay, you may think Florida's pays less for work injury coverage than in other states, especially when we're talking about another 15% rate decrease. You may think that Florida employers enjoy some of the lowest rates in the country, but that's not true. Florida costs are about 11% higher than the national average. And in fact, Florida employers are paying more for this coverage than those in Massachusetts, Illinois, Oregon, and really 30 other states. The third myth is that all states have to require employers to participate in their workers' comp system. That is not true. Now, it is true that most do mandate workers' comp in their state, but there are pockets all throughout the country that allow for some sort of exception. So Tennessee, for example, it allows public employers to do something outside the state system. Wyoming allows non-hazardous employers to also do something outside the system. But Texas is the only state that does not mandate work injury coverage or workers' comp. It's the only state that allows that for private employers. Now, they don't allow it for public employers like Tennessee does, but the point is every state is empowered to make their own rules. So the policy change that I'd like for you to consider today is a dual system where employers are afforded a choice. And it would look something like this: participate in the Florida workers' comp system or sponsor an injury benefit plan. And there are going to be pros and cons to both options. An employer would need to weigh those and make a decision about what works best for their work location, for their injured workers. So here's what the choice would look like. If the employer elected the Florida workers' comp system, they would provide a statutory level of benefits, no decision to make there, it's prescribed by statute. But one of the biggest pros in favor of an employer maintaining workers' comp is that they are afforded that exclusive remedy shield. So that means an employee's remedy for the work-related injury is the workers' comp benefits itself. That's it. So that means that's it. The injured worker cannot sue the employer for negligence, say like a customer would, if that same customer slips and falls in that same work location. The customer could sue in tort. The employee could not, because workers' comp is the exclusive remedy for those workers. Now, contrast that with a sponsor of an injury benefit plan. So typically, in the employee benefit context, employers can define benefits in their benefit plan at their discretion. But in this context, we would recommend a minimum standard of benefits so that not every injured worker has to sue their employer to obtain those benefits. But this is the thing, if they are employed by an employer sponsoring an injury benefit plan, they do not have that employer does not have the benefit of the exclusive remedy shield. That employee has a new potential remedy, a new potential cause of action against their employer. If that employer was negligent and how the employee was injured, and they do not feel like they were adequately compensated by the employer. So as you can imagine, this option would not be right for every employer. Some employers may greatly value exclusive remedy. Others may want to take a little bit more of a risk to have a broader flexibility in how they manage their program. They may want to access doctors that you can't inside the workers' comp system because they don't accept workers' comp patients. And they may just want the opportunity to provide it at a more competitive cost. A dual system like this works because there's competition for the business. And when there's competition for business, the consumer wins. And in this case, it's Florida employers and their injured workers. So I had a couple of things on the slide on the dispute resolution that starts to get a little technical, so I'm gonna skip that for now, and I want to really focus on what is an injury benefit plan. So an injury benefit plan is a type of employee benefit that covers only occupational injuries. It's subject to ERISA, it's subject to those same reporting and disclosure rules. It looks and functions a lot like a disability plan, but it's just there for occupational injuries. So, let's see. These plans have been around in Texas and they have existed since the enactment of Texas workers' comp statute, because Texas never made workers' comp mandatory. It's always been voluntary in that state. So now they became prevalent in the 80s. About 30% of employers in Texas do not participate in the state workers' comp system. Most of those employers sponsor an injury benefit plan, but some don't, because Texas does not regulate minimum standards for these plans. There is a trade association that I'm a member of, AROC, that does set forth minimum standards. But again, Florida doesn't have to do it like Texas. The point is to have a choice to drive improvements across the system as a whole. One of the most compelling reasons why employers will not participate in workers' comp in Florida, in Texas, is because 64% of doctors in Texas do not accept workers' comp patients. Those tend to be highly sought after specialists that if I was injured, that's absolutely where I would want to go. But here's the thing. Employers may pay more for those physicians, but they are motivated by the tort exposure to offer high quality benefits and invest in that in order to avoid that tort exposure. They may invest more in their safety programs because they want to minimize the likelihood of negligence found against them. You may have heard Oklahoma passed an option. It was found unconstitutional by the Oklahoma Supreme Court. It was unique. It provided exclusive remedies, so it's somewhat a system within a system. That's not what I'm proposing today. I want to move towards some data. Several employers that have operations both in Florida and in Texas have taken their Texas option claims and compared it to their workers' comp experience in Florida, and this is what they found. Injured workers under the Texas option have fewer lost time days at work. It's about 15%. The cost of the Texas option programs, those claims are about 40 to 60% less than the Florida workers' comp claims. And despite having exclusive remedy in Florida and having the tort exposure in Texas, the litigation rate in Florida is 5 times higher than that of Texas. This dual system in Texas that creates competition has resulted in the lowest cost for employers in the state. So this is a list where you want to be at the bottom. The lower you are, the lower the cost. Florida ranks 18th in cost. Texas ranks 50th. Here's a quick look at just a deeper dive at the average incurred claim cost. You can see Florida data in blue, Texas in red, and you see very consistent differences across this 6-year period. Here is a look at the litigation rates. Again, over that same period of time, Florida is sitting at about 5.1%, while Texas option claims are at 0.9%. So I think most of us can agree competition is what makes us better. It makes us create, it makes us innovate, it makes us develop product distinctions, better customer service. And in this area, if we can have competition in this space, it will drive change and benefit the ultimate consumer, which is injured workers and their employers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm prepared to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hurlis. You nailed the time, just under 15 minutes on what can be a very complex area of the law, so I appreciate the way you presented it to us today. Members, any questions for Ms. Hurlis on this presentation? Representative Robinson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your great presentation. And I think one of your slides said something about Florida's in a good spot, or it's. But I remember a few years ago, I think when I was first running for office, that was one of, like, almost like property insurance. That was one of the big issues that I heard about from constituents in my area was the workers' comp and awful issues, you know, 6 years ago. And I can't remember why. Do you recall in Florida why we're having those issues and what we did to remedy those problems?
You recognize?
I understand that there was a lot of turmoil around defense costs and how that was working, how that was being, or plaintiff attorney costs and those fees. I can't really say. I am not an expert in workers' comp insurance pricing and underwriting. It's a complex system. I can get back with more information on that if you like.
Representative Snyder, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation today. Just two quick questions. Where workers' comp is optional in these other states, must they go through that benefit plan, or is there some states that allow just no coverage at all?
You're recognized.
Yeah, that gets a little technical. For public employers, they're really not bound by ERISA the same way that private employers are, but typically, when an employer wants to provide some benefits to their employees, and that is a federal rule that governs how those benefit programs are communicated, they have to follow certain rules. So Wyoming, for example, if they choose to sponsor an injury benefit plan there, it's going to be subject to ERISA.
You recognize for a follow-on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for that. Could you go over again? You had mentioned, at least in Texas, where employers do elect the benefit plan, that is driving down litigation exposure. Can you talk about, you know, how within the traditional market, I don't think I was fully following that, with a workers' comp claim, you know, understand kind of the litigation pathway there. How does that benefit plan change that? And can you walk through again what happens if there's an employee-employer dispute?
Yes.
You know, on that claim?
You recognize, Ms. Earless.
If there's employee-employer dispute on injury benefit plan coverage, like is my injury occupational in nature, the benefit plan is going to govern that. I think the litigation rates on the tort exposure is partly in due to the fact that the employers that are making this election, they know the risk. They understand the risk. So they're going to make sure that they're taking excellent care of those injured workers. They're going to make sure that those that are interacting, the adjusters, are taking good care of them, showing empathy. And that really does a lot to lower those litigation rates. So if you're taking good care of them and you're eliminating the primary measure of damages, which is medical and lost time and impairment, and they feel like they're taken care of, then it minimizes likelihood of suit.
One more follow-on. Representative Snyder, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would love to follow up with you afterwards. I probably have more questions that we could cover here today. But my last question for this is, for an applicable large employer who's mandated to offer health insurance, you know, a traditional health insurance plan, how does the workers' comp injury benefit plan differ from just a traditional health insurance offering?
Well, health insurance is there for non-occupational reasons. So this sort of benefit plan is there only for occupational injuries. So if it's occupationally derived, it belongs under workers' comp or an injury benefit plan. If it's non-occupational, then that's appropriate under the health plan system.
Representative Botana, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Quick question about marinas. A few years ago, my family had the issue with the mandated workman's comp, and we actually could not get workman's comp insurance with less than 15 employees. We actually had a stop order approved by, you know, cited to us, and they had to help us. Is this going to make it easier for marinas? Because people come to me all the time asking for 1099s, because if you have less than 10 employees to do with the Longshoremen's Act, you cannot get workman's comp for marinas. Will this help that out? I mean, it's a deep question, but we'll have to follow up to.
You're recognized.
I would say yes. It gives them the ability to have an injury benefit plan and insurance to address the tort exposure. I'm not as familiar with that area of the law and what's required there, but we can talk further about that.
Vice Chair Overdorf, you're recognized. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple questions here. The statistics that you were giving in regards to the tort issues, I'm assuming that those are all prior to the tremendous reforms that we did this last year and last session.
Those are based on the most recent study that we have from the National Academy, well, from the data itself. Those are from, I think it's the experience from 2018 through 2023. So those were claims with a date of injury sometime within that period of time.
You recognize? So in the way I look at insurance, we're always looking at projections going forward. So I'm assuming that the data that you have here does not have any projections going forward associated with the litigation society. You recognize, Ms. Earless?
No, it doesn't.
You have another one, Representative?
Yes, please.
You're recognized. So, being a person that pays workers' comp and for our employees, and being able to go back to my partners every year and say, look, we've got another reduction. This is, and you know, we've seen this basically reduce about 78% since 2003. We've seen it go down and down and down. And it seems like the presentation is kind of a solution in search of a problem for Florida, is my opinion. if Texas is the state that you're citing, and they don't have a mandatory, if you will, workers' comp side of it, what do I do when I go back to my partners now and say, hey, we need to look at options? Why would I do that when I'm looking at, you know, I potentially have a higher cost of litigation associated with what I don't have right now. I've seen a decrease every single year that I've been paying workers' comp. So I'm just asking, why would I go back to my partners and say, hey, I got a great idea for you?
Right. Sir, let's you recognize.
Well, like I said, the insurance premium, those costs are only one cost element. So I would want to look at the data and see, are you really paying less in claims year over year? You probably have a deductible, and that any of those claims incurred before you hit that deductible, that is paid by the employer. I don't see those costs going down. I mean, in fact, even with those costs going down, they're still costing 40 to 60% more in Florida than they are in Texas. And that's for the same operations, the same type of business.
Okay, Vice Chair Overdorf, last question.
I apologize. This is more of a statement than a question, and we don't have debate in this. But I would just say that those statistics are very probably very accurate, but I would look forward in that. And with our new litigation environment here in the state of Florida, I would suggest you're going to see other numbers as we move forward. Thank you.
Address that statement offline. Representative Jacques, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Robinson earlier pointed out that there was a point in our state where workers' comp insurance was at a crisis point, but that hasn't been the case recently. In fact, for 8 consecutive years, we've seen premiums decline. In fact, 11 of the past 12 years, they've declined. And you've referenced this as well in your presentation, that the Office of Insurance Regulation, OIR, here in the state of Florida, has actually ordered a 15.1% rate decrease for businesses, Florida businesses, in 2024. And so my concern is, there's a lot I don't know about the Texas Model Injury Benefit Plan, but I do know these numbers are what they are, and businesses are paying less. And so how can you assure us, if we did go throughout this model, towards this model, that we wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, and now have higher rates and be back to a crisis point? Because, you know, I'm very concerned as a policymaker to tinker with something that doesn't seem to be broken currently.
Ms. Arliss, you're recognized.
I would say, though, respectfully, the employers that have those operations in Florida and in Texas don't feel like the system in Florida is working as well as it should. So competition then itself is going to drive improvements in part. We want the workers' comp system to be strong and to be healthy, and I think competition is what's going to breed that. But it doesn't change. Just because insurance premiums are reducing, that is not the only element of cost, and those other costs continue to increase. So premiums are just one piece of it.
Representative Jacques, you're recognized.
Thank you. But you'd agree with me, premiums is a piece that is consistent and that you can count on. You can count on those costs on a monthly basis, basically. You'd agree with me on that. And in fact, those predictable costs that are going to occur have been decreasing 8 consecutive years.
Yes, sir. The insurance premium for those have been decreasing. The cost of the claim beneath the deductible is not. The average cost per a work-related injury claim for these employers is around $10,000 compared to around $4,500 or $5,000 in Texas. That is a demonstrated difference in cost that those employers are achieving in Texas that they don't have the ability to achieve in Florida.
Representative Jacques, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's a fair point, and I want to address those costs as well. And so my analogy about, you know, the baby out with the bathwater is just, I don't want to affect, you know, the premiums as well. And so going towards this model is kind of, what are the assurances there that we won't see a spike in the premiums now, which are predictable costs that you do have to pay if we do have now a two-prong approach. And that's my concern, because I don't want to be in a situation where we're dealing with an additional insurance crisis while we have others to address.
Right.
Sir, let's you recognize.
Yeah, I you know, we want that market to be strong. If it works for Florida employers in Florida, then remain in workers' comp. But I really have not seen competition increase pricing. Competition is intended and oftentimes makes it better for the consumer ultimately. It doesn't result in higher prices. It really makes the workers' comp system compete.
Representative Barnaby, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Gregory. Thank you for the presentation. You know, it's really important that we get a balanced understanding of workman's comp. For 30 years, I've worked in the industry with businesses as a representative for the National Right Your Congressman, which has been around since 1958. And I've been with the firm for 30 years, representing thousands of businesses in our state who are very familiar with the workman's compensation system. Now, I've been able to meet with experts on workman's comp. I meet with business owners every day in Florida, and I hear their perspectives on our current system. What I have found is that in Florida, we have the greatest system for workman's comp in the entire country, with rates continually decreasing. So my question is, and this is question time, why are we attempting to fix something that is not broken? And I respect, Chair, you bringing this perspective to us as committee members. But again, my question is, why are we attempting to fix something that is not broken? And in closing, let me also state that I'm well aware, obviously, of Texas, what they've implemented in Texas. I'm also aware that the other states has implemented this type of system. The only other attempt to pass this legislation was actually ruled unconstitutional by the Oklahoma State Supreme Court. So I don't think bringing this proposed system, Mr. Chair, to Florida is in our best interest. We should not be replacing a tried and true system for an unproven one that may hurt our workers and our employers here in the great state of Florida. Thank you.
Ms. Hurlis, is there anything you can say to make Representative Barnaby like this bill, this presentation?
Probably not. But I'll tell you, you should take a lot of pride in your workers' comp system. But I'm telling you that employers that I work with look at these numbers and see an opportunity for improvement. And I typically don't know another area in business where competition is hurting ultimately the consumer. That competition is what makes us better. And I think it can bring greater improvement to the Florida workers' comp system if it had something to compete against.
Thank you, Ms. Hurlis. Thank you, members, for your questions. You can tell we've got some representatives here who are into the law and business owners, and we're definitely prepared, not just for this presentation, but for the bills. We appreciate your questions and your debate. I appreciate Representative Chambliss breaking the ice and Representative Joseph's tough questions. Even when we disagree, it's important that we have these discussions publicly. So thanks again for attending here today, Ms. Hurlis. Members, if there's no further business, this concludes our agenda for today's meeting. And Representative Barnaby moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.